Is going to be Professor Jane Ling Wang from University of California at Davis, and she's going to be talking about semi-parametric random effects model for longitudinal data. Please. Okay.
Okay, let me first pop this up so you can. Okay, there we go.
Just put this in your pocket.
Oh, no.
Okay. Just put this in your
Okay, I'm going to start talking to save the time.
The clip.
All right. Sincere thanks to all the organizers for inviting me here. And to those of you who were lucky enough last year to attend the meeting in Argentina, this is the sequel to that talk a year later. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to be exploring some semi-parametric random effects model for either functional or longitudinal data. I'll describe briefly what's the distinction later. By the way, the talk is based on joint work. Let me go back with two collaborators, Jamie Chu and Hans-Jürg Müller. Okay, so I'll start by introducing what's functional data. For each subject or experimental unit, sometimes you actually observed a whole function. The entire curve is observed. Okay, and in this case, we call it functional data, or some people call it curve data. And the data that consists of a sample of n curves. So little n is the sample size here, which refers to the number of subjects or individual. Okay? And for each individual, we observe a curve. And the classical example of functional data is the growth curve for a sample of individual. And sometimes people look at densely sample the longitudinal data as functional data as well. Okay, so longitudinal data are observed over time. Usually you don't observe it very frequently, but you could. So if it's observed very frequently, then people call it functional data instead of longitudinal data. But I'm going to give my own personal view of the distinction between functional data and longitudinal data. They are actually indistinguishable sometimes. Functional data mostly rely on non-parametric methods to analyze that, while longitudinal data traditionally relies on parametric approach, but now also relies on semi-parametric and non-parametric approaches as well. So here's another example of a functional data, also a longitudinal data. And this is a case study regarding the reproduction history of female medflies. And the experiment consists of 1,000 female medflies and the daily reproduction, which is recorded as the total number of eggs laid per day. Very primitive. It's judged just by the number, okay? Was monitored through the lives of 1,000 female medflies. And therefore, we have 1,000 egg-laying curve or fecundity curve, whichever way you like to call it. The data therefore consists of, for each fly, the number of eggs on day T, okay? And I've used the notation Y of T here because later on we are trying to model this. This is our response variable. And we also recorded the lifetime of the flies because it's observed until death. And the total number of eggs, which is the sum of all this, is called lifetime reproduction. Okay. So just to get an idea of what these flies look like, the average lifetime of those 1,000 flies is about 35.6 days. And the average lifetime reproduction is about 759 eggs. So roughly, each fly lays about 20 eggs per day. Okay. Of course, you know, there are peak period and the slow period. Okay, so usually one likes to display the curve to study the structure of the data. Well, here we have 1,000 curves, so I didn't even have to try it. We know that we're not going to be able to see it. So instead, we divide that into four different parts. We stratify these according to the total number of eggs laid. Okay, so divide that according to the quantiles. So this is the first quantile in terms of lifetime reproduction. And even there, it's just too many curves to show. So we randomly sampled 20 from here. And that's the second quantile, third quantile, and the highest quantile. Okay. So you get to see a 20 sampled curve from each quantile. And you can observe from here, as you move up, the total number of eggs or lifetime reproduction, there are more and more peaks. Okay? And the data, except that almost all curves has a strong initial peaks, you know, it's fairly unstructured or noisy. Okay, so the goal is here to study the pattern of reproduction, which is the Y of T that I mentioned earlier, over the lifetime. And also its relation to lifetime and lifetime reproduction. Okay, so these two variables will serve as covariates later on in the study. And in this talk, as I just mentioned, we want to model a curve, which is the pattern of reproduction or the fecundity curve, based on the covariate vector. And we can use either one of them or both of them. Okay. And since I mentioned earlier, those curves are fairly unstructured, we adopted a non-parametric approach. Actually, it's a semi-parametric approach, as you will see later. Okay. And this is based on the functional principal component analysis, which is commonly adopted for the functional data. Okay, so now I'm going to give you a little bit of the distinction between functional data and longitudinal data. I've already mentioned, actually, functional data most likely is some kind of longitudinal data, such as the fecundity curves, because we observe the number of eggs over the lifetime. Okay. And traditionally, functional data are considered as a realization of smooth paths. Okay, usually an L2 stochastic process. But for longitudinal data, usually it's treated as multivariate data instead. You observe each individual at different time points. The time points may be different. Okay, so this is called irregular sampling plan. And you might have different number of observations for different individuals. But nevertheless, when you handle the longitudinal data, we treat them just as vector for each individual. Okay. And some people distinguish between functional data and longitudinal data, as I said, by the recording frequency. That's one way you might want to do that. Okay, because of the recording frequency difference, you might want to use different method. But nowadays, actually, people are starting to merge the field. Okay? There are functional approaches to analyze longitudinal data where the recording is fairly infrequent, just like typical longitudinal data. So that's no longer really the division between the two type of approach. And another approach which I used to think is that functional data use usually non-parametric approach to handle, and longitudinal data traditionally one use parametric approach. But even that now seems to become blurred. Okay, so I think I like to look at it. The distinction is the following. When you treat functional data, we remember that we say we regard it as a realization of smooth path. So the adjacency is taken into account of the data. In other words, when you look at the data, you usually try to borrow information from the neighboring observations. Okay? While with longitudinal data, they were treated like vectors. So that adjacency is usually not built in the modeling approach. And a reference for functional data analysis, which probably many of you are familiar by now, is the book by Ramsey and Silverman. Okay, so since I'm going to use the functional principle component analysis approach, I'll start with a brief overview. So first, let's look at the case. There is no covariate. Okay, that's what's been done in the literature. So you start with a stochastic process, Yt, that you are interested in, and the mean function is called a function of t, of course. It's called mu of t. The covariance function, sigma, at two different time points, s and t. And you have then the eigenvalue denoted by lambda, and the corresponding eigenvector denoted by rho of the covariance function sigma here. Okay, so this is the standard terminology for principal components. Okay, so the next one, which is crucial, is the so-called Kahunen-Loeb expansion or decomposition of L2 process. And what it is, it's really just the principal component decomposition of the curve or of a function. Okay, so if you know in multivariate analysis, you can decompose any vector through the principal components. Use that as the base, and this is exactly the same. Okay, so you first center it around its mean, and then here you use the eigenfunction, rho sub k, as your base. Okay, and the coefficient here, a sub k, is the principal component score, and it's random. Okay, so these are the standard notation for principal components. Okay, and for functional data, Rice and Silverman first provided the estimating procedure for both the covariance structure and the eigenfunction and the mean function as well. And that paper started by dealing with equally sampled functional data. In other words, everybody have the same observation point, such as the MedFly study we have just seen. Okay, but this is actually a luxury. Typical data are not regularly sampled. So in the second paper, they extend this to incorporate irregular sample data and also to handle sparse data as well. Oops. Okay, so now that I have introduced the functional principal component approach, we're now going to include the covariates as well in the setup. Okay. And as mentioned earlier, we have two possible candidates here for that case study. One is the lifetime of the fly, and the other one is the lifetime reproduction. Okay, so let's look at it again, the functional principal component without covariates. Okay, and now we have covariates, so we like to somehow put it into the model. And one natural way to do that is then perhaps both the mean and the random components, okay, these are the principal component scores, may be influenced by the covariates. Okay, and to allow for some generality, we will decompose the covariates into two parts, a U part and another vector V. Okay. The U part is the part which influences only the mean components, because some covariates may only influence the mean part, and some may influence the stochastic part. Okay? So this allows you the flexibility to do so. And typically, U is equal to V. That's quite common. Okay? Or V, the random components, which is the random effect here, is going to be part of U. In other words, you use some of the covariates, but not necessarily all of them. Those which you consider to have a random effect on the subject. Okay, so if we do that, then we sneak in U and V, one to the mean part and one to the random components part. I'm starting to call this change to M instead, just so that you don't get confused with the original mean over there. Okay? The mean now changes with the covariate. Okay, so another way to look at it, those of you who are familiar with the mixed effect model, you can think of this mean part as the fixed effect induced by the covariate U. And this part here is the Rendon effects part. Okay, remember that this is Rendon. Okay, and so they contribute to the stochastic part of the process there. Okay, so we like now to look at the regression function, which means we conditioning Y over the covariates. Okay, and because the way we set up, the assumption is the following. Okay, the conditional mean of Y given the covariate Z, where the mean part depends only on the variable U. Okay, so mu T U here now is the conditional expectation of this M function over U. Okay, and okay, that gives you this part. Now look at this part over here. Well, obviously this is random, so the conditional expectation will take place over there, and we call this eta sub K. Okay, that's the conditional mean over here. All right, and then from here you can calculate the covariance structure at two different time points, given again the covariance Z, which again is only affected through the V variable here. Okay, because we have designed the process in such a way that U affects the mean and V affects the random component. But as you can see, in fact, V not only affects the random component parts, it actually contributes also to what? The mean part. Okay? This variable, AKV, itself has mean zero. Okay? But when you're conditioning over V, it's no longer necessarily mean zero. Okay? So there is a conditional mean part which comes in to contribute to the overall conditional mean that way. This is rather awkward. Okay, maybe you're not used to this, but this is because of the nonlinearity of the random effects. If you have a linear mixed effect model, this part will vanish when you take expected value. Okay, so you wouldn't see, you know, the contribution from there. But because of the nonlinear structure, we haven't, you know, restricted this to a linear structure. So you are left actually with a contribution from the original random components as well, which is basically the conditional mean of that random components. Okay, so is that clear so far? All right. And over there, both the mu, which is the conditional mean now, or given the covariate, and the eta, which is the conditional components, given, again, the covariates, are completely unspecified. So they are non-parametric in that sense. Okay. So if we do that, let me show you the previous page again. So normally, if you allow these to be completely non-parametric, this one will involve a dimension smoothing, which is the dimension of V. Okay, this one here is even one more dimension. It's the dimension of U plus one, because there is a time factor there as well. Okay, so that means you have to deal with a high dimensional smoothing procedure if you leave this completely unspecified. Okay, so in order to come up with a more parsimonious model, we adopt a semi-parametric approach. Okay, so the semi-parametric approach is the following. Then, let me start with this one. That's easier. Okay, so this is the part coming from the random effects, the mean of the random effects. So we are going to say that it's a function of the vector v, but only through what? One direction or one index. Okay. So beta k times v is a one-dimensional variable now. So the vector v affects eta only through what? This index here. Okay. And therefore, alpha k is still unknown here, but now we are dealing with only what? A one-dimensional smoothing instead of original, a q-dimensional smoothing here. Okay. All right, so we do the same for the mean part as well. But because mean has an additional dimension, which is the time t, we decide to decompose them into two components as a product model. Okay, one is a function of t only, and the other one is function of u only. And again, this function of u affect the mu only through another index, which is called gamma prime u here. Okay, so there is an index gamma which comes in in the mixed effect, fixed effect part, and then there are betas, beta 1, beta 2, etc., okay, that comes in through the random components part. Okay, and I will explain a little bit later why we decide to do this decomposition. If you don't do that, okay, then what you could do is to have a function of T and then gamma prime U. But then you need to deal with two-dimensional smoothing, which is not too bad, okay? So that's also an alternative. But for this particular data set, this works quite well. And as I said, I will explain it later on. Actually, the explanation is here, okay? So let me maybe jump to here then. The explanation, as I said here, is that if you go back to look at the original regression function, the expected value of y given z, now it's of this form. Okay. If you look at this, you can see that this is a function of t times function of the covariance plus a whole bunch of function of the covariance times the function of t. Okay. So the fact, hope is the following. If you use enough components here, and you can pretty much eventually expand any function into a product of t times something else. Okay. So that was part of the reason why we had selected a product form for the fixed effect part, other than the fact that it fits the data, at least for one of the covariates, quite well. All right, and then you also have the corresponding covariance structure. There's nothing really new over there. Okay, now I'm going to go back to the identifiability problem. Because the directions and the link alpha are both unknown, then the beta is not identifiable because you can blow up the scale arbitrarily. Okay, so we assume that all those vectors which affect the indices beta and the gamma together are univariate vector. Okay, and the positive direction to get away with the identifiability problem. And also for this one here, the fixed mean effect parts, it's decomposed again as two non-parametric unknown function. So again, we need to insert some conditions for identifiability. So we made this mu 1 component to have mean 1. Okay, and the reason is that when you take expected value of this, this gets out. So you have exactly what? The mu naught is like the baseline, the mean. In other words, it's the overall average of all y sub t, regardless of the covariates associated with it. Okay, so the model may look quite complicated, especially if it's the first time you encounter it. But as a matter of fact, it's actually quite flexible in the following sense. It includes several special models, and one of them actually we are all familiar with, which I will go into that later. And as I mentioned already, because of the you get to choose how many components to include in your model, you have some flexibility there in terms of the mean structure and the covariance structure of your data there. And you might want to compare this to the nonlinear mixed effects model, or what's called the generalized linear mixed effect model, which takes this form. Okay? So this can be considered maybe as an alternative to analyze nonlinear mixed effect model. But the reason is that the generalized linear mixed effect model often has computational difficulties. Okay? The procedure that we propose here is, I wouldn't really say it's straightforward. Okay? You probably have to write your own code, but at least it involves only one-dimensional smoothing in there. Okay, so we will propose procedure to estimate both the indices. Remember, there's the gammas and the betas over there, a whole bunch of them. Okay, but each one only involves one-dimensional smoothing and also the unknown link function over here. Okay, now let me look at a special case to show you that if the domain of the curve, earlier I had said that we observed the yt over an interval I, okay, we call that. If that actually is just a singleton, a single point, then y is just a one-dimensional random variable here, okay? And there is only one eigenfunction in that case, which is 1, okay? And the model that I showed a few minutes ago turns out to be the generalized linear model with one-dimensional response variable. Okay? If you further assume the unknown link and the variance function are identical here. Okay? So generalized linear model can be considered as a special case of that. Okay? And a second special case is this one. If we don't have a fixed effect variable u, in other words, if there is no u variable, then we have the special random effects model. Okay, over here. In other words, there is no u here anymore. Okay? This was the model that I mentioned last year in Argentina. Okay? And the second special case is now if you do not allow the random components v, then you get the multiplicative model. Okay, this is the fixed effect part. Okay, with the random error there. And I also mentioned that model last year. Okay, so the current model is an extension of both. Okay, and in these two special cases, the computation actually turns out to be also simpler than the more general model that I will describe. Okay, and it's probably not surprising to learn that. And it turns out that for the egg-laying data that I showed a while ago, if we choose U to be E only, the total number of eggs or lifetime reproduction in here, it model actually it quite well. Okay, or if we use this model here, again, choose V to be only the lifetime reproduction, it also did a pretty good job. Okay, and one of the building blocks, actually, of our algorithm is the procedure for a generalized linear model with an unknown link and an unknown variance function. Usually, when you apply generalized linear model procedure, you have to specify the link function, and you have to specify a variance structure. So if you decide to use quasi-likelihood, you can do that. Okay, so the two co-authors, Chu and Mueller, proposed a method which allows you to not specifying the link and the variance function, okay? And therefore, you don't have to decide the model in advance, okay? Well, I guess that I consider my ticket to robustness. Okay? It's not quite robust, but at least you don't need a model assumption there. Okay, so how much time do I have? 10, okay. All right, so then I'll describe a little bit about the estimation procedure. It actually is probably best, I'll just break it down to three major steps and bypass the little detail, because otherwise it gets too confusing. Okay. All right, so in reality, you don't actually observe the entire curve. When I say that you observe the entire curve, there is a limitation in recording. So in reality, even if you like to look at them as a curve data, you only get to observe at what? Several time points over there, okay? And Ni is the lifetime, in this case, of the ice medfly for that medfly example there. Okay, so what we can do is the following. Okay, we first start with an initial estimate of the fixed effect. Okay, that's the fixed effect component. You start somehow with a component there, and there are ways you can get started as well. Okay, so once you have that, then you can proceed to estimate the eigenfunction because you can just subtract the fixed effect from your observed curve and then do the principal component analysis using either the method of Rice-Silverman or Rice and Wu, okay, of functional principal component analysis. Rice and Silverman used smoothing spline as the smoothing procedure, and we use local polynomial smoother. And the smoother actually is arbitrary. It can be your favorite smoother. You get to choose the smoother. Okay. Okay, and that's another procedure. All right, so now that we have that, maybe let me pop up the model to remind you again, because... Okay, there it is, okay, to refresh your memory here. Okay, so the conditional mean has this part plus this other one, okay? And then you have the covariance structure there. So actually, let me go back one more even. All right, coming to here. This is what originally started, the original data, okay? All right, so if you subtract the mean part away from there, okay, so now that we have the principal components, initial principal components, rho k, okay? Well, the next thing is that we now need to get this. Okay, remember this is the conditional expectation of ak given the covariates v. So that you can do through a nonparametric smoothing. However, we have further imposed that it's related to the function only through an indices. Okay? So this is the step. In order to estimate that, you need to apply the generalized linear model approach. Okay? Because you can think of this as a generalized linear model where the link is unknown. Okay? And the variance function is also not specified. So we adopted the method which I'm going to bypass here to estimate those components. And they are specified in the two papers, one in JASA and one in Annals of Statistics. All right, so now that we have the eta function, we can now go back to update the fixed effect. Okay? And I think I'll bypass this. Okay? So basically, you go back to update it, and this is it. Okay? Now you go back to the beginning and start the iteration until it converges. All right, and as I said, in between the building block is the generalized linear model procedure, which accommodates both the unknown link and the unknown variance function. Okay, then from there, once you are able to estimate all the components, you can do prediction like you normally would do. Stick anything unknown into what? It to get a prediction. You can the question of how many components should be used over here. Okay, this is the big K here. We use the cross-validation in the data example, which I will demonstrate later. And one can also use AIC or BIC, any model selection procedure. Okay, the smoothing parameter, we also use cross-validation. Okay. All right, so to make the long story short, basically, we are able to get a consistency only at this point for the procedure, okay? And for the index or the parameter associated with the index, beta particularly, if we are willing to assume that the link function is null, okay, then you get the root n consistency over there. Okay, so let's get back to the fecundity data, the reproduction history here. Okay, so now we are going to try to model the reproduction pattern y of t using lifetime reproduction first. Okay, and the reason is because it's not just for the pleasure of doing the modeling. The reason is because evolution is usually driven by reproduction success. Okay. And we measure the reproduction success as the lifetime reproduction. How many eggs a fly can lay in a lifetime? Okay, and we like to know then, if a fly is able to lay a lot more eggs than another one, how is it done over the course of the lifetime? Is it done uniformly, you know, more, or is it that they dispose a lot in the beginning, or is it because they save a lot in the end of the lifetime, okay? So we like to see the pattern associated with the total reproduction. All right. I made some preliminary decision, which I'm going to skip, okay? Basically, we drop all those flies that are infertile, and we truncated the interval also up to only day 50. Okay? And the reason is because the data is fairly noisy, if you recall from earlier, and trying to model every fly through the course of lifetime, the longest fly lives over 100 days. Flies are not like human. Okay? Some flies can live 7-8 times of the typical fly. Okay? So we have to cut it at some point, which we did. And there was a reason, actually, why we cut it on day 50, but I will not elaborate on that. It's in another paper which appeared in Journal of Gerontology. It's in the reference of the abstract, actually. Okay, so first we tried to do the case of a single covariate and using lifetime reproduction. Okay, and we ignored at this point that we assume there is no effect of the lifetime reproduction on the mean part. Okay, in other words, it only affects the random components. Okay. Because that's a simple beginning. First, we want to see whether this, how this particular model captured the data. So here's the model. Okay, this remains the same as earlier, except Z is the lifetime reproduction here, and there is no other covariate here. Okay, so here's the result of using the procedure here. If one uses one principal component there, the prediction error is 333. Two components drop it to 313, etc. Okay. Actually, I don't have that one here. In order to see how this does, okay, we compare it to a model where there is no covariate utilized at all. In other words, we are back to the model. We just use the average curve to make the prediction. And that model has a prediction error of 462 or 65. Okay, so the prediction error is reduced by about, I guess, one-third by using just one component. Okay, so that was a rather encouraging sign. Oh, there it is. Okay. So from 462 down to 333 with just one component. And by adding additional component, it's still reduced, but really not by that much. Okay, and we decide to choose two components. Okay, and the reason is, if you go back here to look at it, this is actually indeed the lowest prediction error where it occurs. Okay. But that's not usually the only criteria you decide to stop there, okay? We decided there because when we look at also the regression function, the alphas here, here are the first four alpha here. You can see the third and the fourth one are fairly flat, which suggests also there's probably no need to include them in the model, okay? In addition to the prediction error, okay? So we stopped right here, using only the first two components. And here's the surface, okay? The prediction surface after we adopted the model. So you can see from here now, all flies has a reproduction peak fairly early on, okay? And it shifted slightly or a little bit as for a fly that produced more. And these four curves are just a cross-sectional curve for a fly that produced 400 eggs. It's this one, 800, 1200, and 1600, just so that you can see it more clearly. Okay, so we also did the, I think I need to stop here. Okay. So we also did the case for multiple covariates, okay, using both the total number of eggs and the lifespan. So, and this time we use UV to be the same. Both affects the fixed component and the random components, okay? Before I show you that, I would like to make the story here. The reason we didn't do it for the lifetime is actually we did it, and it didn't perform very well, okay? Lifetime is much more elusive. So using that variable alone is not sufficient. Okay, so there we go. Okay, here is the corresponding alpha function. Again, it looks fairly flat for the third and the fourth components. Okay. Oops. Okay. And if you plot the mean function against the linear predictor, this is increasing. Okay, that's the non-parametrically. And here's, again, the regression surface. Okay, so let me stop here and then maybe just go back to the conclusion. Okay, so here we have a semi-parametric random effects model for functional or longitudinal data. The model is fairly flexible, and it works pretty good for the egg-laying data if you choose the right covariates. It doesn't always work. Okay, you might have to try harder. And the algorithm to compute them, as I say, involves only one-dimensional smoothing. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you.
How is it possible in your model to use time-varying covariates?
Actually, I was thinking, I think you could, actually, because you just record, you know, the corresponding points as you enter in your algorithm. So I don't think, you know, I was thinking about that, actually. So I think it could, actually. Yeah.
Yes. In these orthogonal decompositions of the L2 space that you use with these row functions, in the multivariate setting, there is also something called the singular value decomposition.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Is there something analogous here that you can use?
We use just the principal component, basically, in here. Yeah, but they are very, of course, you know, basically it's a matter of choosing the base. So there are lots of different ways one can select the base.
The same. Yeah. It's just sort of an algorithm that helps you compute it in each way.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Small announcements to make. There is one talk that has been cancelled on session A of the room. It's the last one by Dr. Brian Gajewski. So, section A, we have only two talks, and section B will be complete. And also, note that section B has been moved to LSK 301 upstairs.
Oh, the microphone.